Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UA Little Rock Public Radio. The Arkansas Symphony's 1718 season was announced in the early spring, but so much of the weeks between then and now has been taken up by the highlights of the 1617 season. All facets: intimate neighborhood concerts, river rhapsodies, side-by-side, chamber music, new composers. But now that July the 4th is behind us, we can turn to the largesse to come. And my guest today is Philip Mann, as music director-conductor, to take us through the 1718 Masterworks series. The River Rhapsodies will follow later this month, with other program series ahead.
I'd say one of the things about this season that I'm looking forward to most, that this program fits into, as does most of the others, that this is really a celebration of what's possible with the full symphony orchestra. The spotlight is placed squarely on our musicians and this wonderful organization of the Arkansas Symphony, where we highlight individual musicians, we highlight our staff conductor, and we really, for the first time in several years, are making a conscious and consistent effort to include the full symphony orchestra on virtually every program. So you're going to see full brass sections, full percussion, and really fully exploring the possibilities of our new home, the Robinson. Go is absolutely a concert opener, and I see it in the traditional sense of something like a Overture to Candide or the Ruslan and Ludmila or Marriage of Figaro Overture. It has that kind of that joie de vivre, that spark and that fire, and it really sets us up into a position of listening to color and rhythm and texture in a way that I'm particularly interested in how our ears will be attuned for the possibilities of the Sibelius, because the Sibelius gives us quintessentially Finnish, Scandinavian kind of color palette, but it is infused with the kind of passion and romanticism that has come with the performance practice tradition of great violinists who have tackled that piece. And at the same time, it balances the nationalism of the Finnish voice that Sibelius is perhaps the greatest proponent of.
And then Brahms.
And then the Brahms. And of course, this Brahms, for me, has a weight that is perhaps equal to the next three symphonies together. Part of that, I think, is because it took him so long to write. I mean, he agonized over it. He struggled on, you know, cognizant of the yoke of the Beethoven symphonies, the Mozart and Haydn preceding, and really that he wanted to be a great symphonist. And that's why this work, it didn't flow out of his pen and in his mind the way the second and third symphony and then the fourth later would very quickly. This took about 12 and a half years of revisions and entering the, you know, sitting on top of the desk and then going back into the drawer and back and forth. And the piece feels like that. It doesn't feel like an easy conversation sometimes. It feels like there is so much there to uncover, to elucidate, to bring forward. And it's why it's a great challenge and joy as a conductor to tackle this work. Mm-hmm. But it has a density to it that's completely absent in the second symphony, which we've recently heard here. The finale, at the time seen as a direct reminiscence of the finale of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the Great Choral Symphony in Ode to Joy. There is certainly a familiarity and a similarity there to the themes. But the three movements that precede it too all set you up so perfectly for it. It's a great way to open the season. It's a great way to set a tone kind of triumph and of success and of collective voices sharing the stage together that will be followed up with a full symphony orchestra.
And then the next one, you call the French Connection. Jeffrey is the conductor. Mm-hmm. And you call him the staff conductor. Is that what his official title is?
His official title is associate conductor of the Arkansas Symphony and music director of our youth ensembles.
Second one is therefore the Mio and the Ravel, then the break, and then the Debussy comes at the end?
That's right.
Ah, okay. And the Kurt Weill is after the break.
Correct.
Great. So talk about those.
this is an absolutely exquisite program. I'm proud of the way we put it together, and I think it's a perfect match also for Jeffrey Robson's sensibilities as a musician. We're fortunate to have a musician of his caliber and his experience as part of our Arkansas Symphony. And as you've mentioned, you know, he's such a part of the fabric of our musical life here in Central Arkansas, with his connections with the Faulkner Festival and the Chamber Music Society of Little Rock. And you, of course, he's a regular on stage with the ASO on numerous different series, but most people around town would also recognize him as our music director of our youth ensembles. And as a music director, one of the things that's really important to me is the continued development, the opportunities that we offer for our staff conductors, in this case, our associate conductor. So this was a perfect opportunity to match a wonderful program, an evocative program that has influences that really match Jeff's background. There's humor in this, jazz, there's American influence, and what we really find in this program are four complementary pieces of the beginning of the 20th century that, if you think of continental Europe at the time, you know, starting in like 1920 and going up to the mid-30s, you have all of these influences from all across the world that are starting to break into the scene, especially in Paris. You've got people like Satie looking back towards Stravinsky, people resisting the mysticism of Franck, and people like Millot bringing their experiences from Brazil. And this first piece on the program, the Cow on a Roof, and it's full of humor, and it has a very French, colorful palette of orchestration, but the forms that are represented are things like the samba and the tango, and were the result of a trip that he took to Brazil just not long before writing the work. We follow that up with another work that is very much influenced by jazz and by one of the great, of course, French impressionists, Ravel. And the G major piano concerto features not just G, a young up-and-coming pianist, a winner of Concert Artists International, someone I know will connect with our audiences very well, but also features one of our musicians, because it's one of the most well-known and popular English horn solos in this sublime second movement. So we'll have our very own Elizabeth Wheeler featured on that work. And we follow the first half up, which is a jazz-influenced French program, with here we are having a German composer, but who's been tremendously influenced by French musical culture and French orchestration. Now, around 1921, he writes it in one movement, but he's at the time actually studying with Busoni, and he was accepted as one of Busoni's, one of five master students that he had. And you can sense in this kind of, you know, at the very beginning of his musical kind of career and life and developing of a voice, you can hear how he starts to work out the voices that would later be used in Three Penny Opera and some of his more popular works. Because it's only one movement, it allows us to also feature another work that follows it, the Petite Suite of Debussy. And this is a piece that gives all musicians a smile on their face. Again, it has jazz influence, just like the viol and the other two works. But it's a work that originally found its home on two pianos, you know, four hands, and four movements, and built in four little dance movements. And it is fun. It's full of humor and color again. And I think all of these four pieces together will offer a little bit of a playground for our musicians. It'll be an opportunity for Jeff to really showcase his personality, especially his background in jazz. And I just think this is one of these kind of combinations of repertoire that just tastes great. And I love how it looks on the page, and I think it'll sound even better in the hall.
Now, before we move on to the third, we need a little comment from you about Frauci.
Yes, we're thrilled to have Jennifer Frauci back. She comes back by popular demand. I've had the opportunity to work with her with other orchestras around the country, and I've actually engaged her here in Arkansas as well. She played the Barber Concerto with a guest conductor, but this will be the first time we've had the opportunity to share the stage in Arkansas. So we've been in touch several times over the last few months. You know, I've tracked where she's been and vice versa, and we were thrilled to bring the collaboration, especially in the Sibelius. She has a real sense of color, and then that sounds like a broad kind of not a very specific kind of notion as a violinist, but when you think about the possibilities of a single note on the violin and the many different ways that you can play a single note, even not taking into account that you have four strings, that all of which could play that note perhaps, and the different bow strokes and all the different possibilities. She has a tremendous range that is very rare, and I think it'll be perfectly suited to the Sibelius. As I mentioned, you know, the subtle shades of color and the changes and what that means to the musical message, and when a musician decides consciously to change these shades for even within a phrase, it can have profound results. And I think this is really one of the things that she brings to the table. Not to mention she was, you know, a young prodigy with great chops and virtuosity. But I'm looking forward for that collaboration tremendously.
And then, of course, we'll hear more about her at the
She'll be our artist of distinction on the River Rhapsodies as well.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. Okay, so now we come to Romeo and Juliet. And I looked at that and I thought, well, you said the first was the French connection, and this is the Russian connection.
It is, but I'm a little bit tongue-in-cheek here, because all three of those works, the Kabalevsky Overture, the Prokofiev Romeo and Juliet, and the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances, are heavily influenced by French orchestration. Of course, and actually, Western and going even further into the New World elements as well. And so this is a common thread that has provided me a little bit of pleasure in crafting this season. But it's not a coincidence either, because when we made the conscious choice to include more musicians on stage and to feature the full symphony orchestra, naturally you're going to start to gravitate towards works of a certain time period, and that would mean, you know, at least late Romantic and then into the 20th century, and that means you have the influences of the Impressionists and maybe, you know, late 19th century German Romantics and Russian Romantics, and so this program, it does look like the Russian connection, but it brings lots of influences to the table. The Kabalevsky Overture is just tremendous fun. It is full of humor. And then we follow that up with one of the most timeless and well-known stories, of course, of Romeo and Juliet. And Prokofiev, in his ballet, he depicts it with almost like a technicolor type orchestration, something like surrealist, in a way that there's a clarity that is so clear that it almost becomes a challenge to work with on stage. And that's partly created with using widely disparate ranges of instruments, incredibly low with incredibly high at the same time. There's this sheen. This is a piece that I've saved for the Arkansas Symphony. This is a very virtuosic work, but it's a virtuosic work with the clarity and the intimacy of a Haydn symphony, despite the fact we'll have 95 people probably on stage for this program. You can see through these textures in the similar way that you might be able to see through something like The Firebird of Stravinsky. And it's not a coincidence, again, that these are ballet scores, so these textures are evocative of the ballet pit, the orchestra. Orchestra pit. The depiction of the Montagues and the Capulets will be immediately recognizable to all the listeners. It's something that youth orchestras play. It's something that you've heard in lots of film scores. But it's actually all of these interior movements that look at the relationships of the character, the development of the drama, that Prokofiev really comes into his own.
My guest is Philip Mann, Arkansas Symphony's music director, conductor, as he expands upon the masterwork's delights in store.
We follow up this really blockbuster first half with one of the great orchestral showpieces of all time, Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances. Now, all three of these works have their home in some ways at the keyboard, in terms of whether it was compositionally or during the process of composition, or in this case, Rachmaninoff's, you know, one of the great pianists of all time, and having written these symphonic dances partly at the keyboard. And you hear partly in the way it's constructed, almost the way his hands would have played. Rachmaninoff, for pianists, is famous, or perhaps maybe the better word would be infamous, for these broad textures, 10-note chords, all five fingers in both hands working all the time. And that's why it's so suitable for a program like this, because we're going to use all 100 of our musicians. You know, all the forces will be playing. And it's a compositional tour de force in a way that it includes multiple themes happening simultaneously, almost in a Wagnerian fashion. It uses the well-known and recognizable Dies Irae theme as one of its principal themes. Again, deals with this notion of death and triumph. And then it unabashedly gives a little bit of showmanship in typically Rachmaninoff fashion. It's a blockbuster pyrotechnic work that has also some of the great most recognizable sweeping love melodies that would be reminiscent or evocative of something like the second piano concerto or the third piano concerto. So all of these things really kind of work very well to me together. And if there was an unnamed person on this program that kind of has a hand in all of it, I think it's probably Tchaikovsky.
Well, going on to the next, you brought in Tchaikovsky. And Tchaikovsky's passion.
We'll begin with selections from Carmen, and it will be some of my favorite bits and some of the maybe lesser celebrated moments in one of the great hits of opera of all time. And I think that one of the reasons for its enduring appeal is that you sure it has some recognizable things that we all know immediately. But it's like every single number in that opera is a fantastic piece of music. It's not a matter of we love this one and then, as they say about Wagner, you know, those 60 seconds of great music followed by 15-minute periods. You know, I don't subscribe to that idea, but that's a famous quote. But Bizet, it's just a hit parade, every single number. So we're going to explore from the suites some of the really wonderful kind of passionate and evocative dance forms, the Spanish dance forms that Bizet used in that kind of French milieu at the time that was just sweeping, that Spanish craze that was sweeping Paris at the time. It's a wonderful pairing to Defia's Nights in the Garden of Spain. Defia, in a somewhat of an impressionistic context, paints these exquisite images of these gardens of Spain in rushing whirls of fountains of sound. And there's all a sense of kind of spinning and tremendous color, these rich, dark Spanish textures. And it gives us, it's a passionate, beautiful work. It's evocative of love and just hot, warm blood. And it's a great combination for our soloist of that program, which is Tatiana Reutemann-Mann. And she's by far our most requested soloist, and it's taken me far too long to make this collaboration happen. But I'm particularly happy with this specific repertoire choice because I think it's a wonderful match for her sensibilities. She's a fiery musician of great passion and depth. And I actually spoke to another conductor who she played this with, who you will remember, Imre Palo, Kodály's godson and eminent Hungarian conductor. And he called me up actually backstage and he said, "Tatiana, just knock this out of the park. You have to program this piece with her. Your audiences will love it." And I hold him in great esteem, so it didn't take much more convincing than that for me.
Now, does that come immediately after the Bizet?
It does. And so that's our first half. It's a little bit of a shorter first half because the scale of the work on the second half, also the emotional breadth and weight of the second half really has to, the scales are not equal on this program in terms of first half, second half. The first half is tremendously enjoyable and something you can sit there and just let the sound wash over you. The second half, you have to be emotionally ready for a journey that will pull you in several different directions. It's going to put us through the ringer, so to speak, in the Pathetic Symphony of Tchaikovsky. Perhaps his greatest work, according to many musicologists.
Is that the one that's asked for the most?
I think probably his Fourth and Fifth Symphony are programmed more frequently. Certainly, I think the Tchaikovsky, the Violin Concerto, and maybe the First Piano Concerto is most. And then there are things like the Romeo and Juliet Overture Fantasy that are programmed quite a bit. But I think when you want to sense the full scope of his character, of his lifelong struggle with various pressures on his personal life, this is the place where you really get to know the real McCoy of Tchaikovsky. It's in trying to understand and reconcile the interior conflicts that are played out in a symphonic genre. You know, you have the symphonic form, which in a way is built, structured to deal with conflict. It's why someone like Sibelius, for instance, he decided to become a symphonist because he thought that form was the best way for him to address a specific topic. But this is a work that also has a bit of a flexibility to it that I wanted to wait until we had danced a while together before we did this, because the part of the tension and the working out of these deep emotional challenges that are built into this piece is how you do it in tremendously lovely music. And we should all feel like we had really gone through something when we get to the end of this piece.
And now, have you done the Planets before?
This will be my first time doing the Planets here in Arkansas, and this is a program to take us places. I mean, all three of these works are just bang up showpieces for orchestra. They all offer something a little bit different. And this is probably the best example of anything on our season of how we're focusing our talents.
And the order, does it start with the Adams again?
Short Ride in a Fast Machine, and then Strauss, Also Sprach Zarathustra, and then intermission, Holst's The Planets. We have a season here where we have several kind of quintessential concert openers, and there are very few written in the 20th century that you would think of before Short Ride in a Fast Machine as a crackerjack concert opener. It depicts musically exactly what the title says. It's a short ride in a fast machine. It's 4 minutes of just romping, crazy, fast-paced sound, and it's all held together by a sound that we now think of is absolutely John Adams, and it's the temple block, you know, a wood block that is beat in just in constant motion with a specific unchanging rhythm. And it kind of provides the backbone, the skeletal substance that holds this giant texture together, because it is a very, very large orchestra. Yeah, he's one of the most well-known and respected American composers right now, and actually has been commissioned by people like the Metropolitan Opera, and has written some very important works for the operatic world. Nixon in China is certainly one of the most important American contributions to the operatic repertoire of the 20th century. So we follow up this Short Ride in a Fast Machine, which the musicians are already all abuzz about. They've been wanting to play this for years, with one of the great tone poems that features virtually every individual musician in the orchestra, and that's Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra. Now, of course, your listeners will immediately recognize the beginning of that, because it was the soundtrack to the film score to 2001, A Space Odyssey. So you have that, yeah, with the timpani and the horns and brass all playing this fanfare to begin. But really, that's just the very beginning of a tremendously powerful, inventive, intellectual exploration into Nietzsche's philosophy and the notion of the cosmic life after death, the notion of a greater power and being. And I think it's appropriate, not just because it gives us a sense of spaceships and all that, but it deals with the same material that Holst's Planets do. It's just that in the way that Holst's planets treat that material, it's the goddesses and gods and how that what they represented in mythology. So all of your listeners will of course remember and recognize the Planets. But I would want to mention about the Planets a couple interesting things. You know, often you don't think of the Planets as a choral work, because it's rare that you even hear the women's chorus utilized at the end. And we will have a women's chorus, and I think it will be quite an interesting effect, because in our new space of the Robinson, one of the most resonant spaces that seems to project sound is in that grand tier area. So specific placement and positioning of the women's chorus should provide a little bit of a kind of celestial cover that you won't necessarily see the singers, but you'll feel their presence and you'll hear them. But it's this notion of kind of feeling their presence that I think adds a very special and unique feel to the end of that piece. The Planets, we think of Mars, the bringer of war, as maybe its most recognizable movement. And a lot of people, it's been used in lots of film scores and soundtracks, and youth orchestras have played this, and orchestras have used it as a showpiece, as an encore piece, and things like this. But really, there are some of the other movements, like Jupiter, that are, to me, some of the most quintessentially British-sounding music of that great romantic orchestral repertoire. And he uses hymn themes and puts them ironically into a mythological context, but the result are some movements of just tremendous and beautiful music that gets us all looking upward and thinking big cosmic thoughts.
Last year, you did for the first time put Beethoven and Blue Jeans as the last one of the season, and now you're doing it at the same time, but for a different reason.
It's a different reason. And, you know, there are always lots of different cooks in the kitchen and reasons why things happen on programming. In this case, it had to do with the calendar year and a National Endowment for the Arts grant and some things like this. We certainly love that positioning in November of Beethoven and Blue Jeans, but we've had success with it in April as well. So you'll probably see it in the future moving around as it makes sense with the weather and with the people's schedules, as it were.
So Barry Thomas Painter.
Barry will actually be featured on the second half of this program in an eclectic and innovative setting of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, the Sixth. That being said, before we get to that visual arts collaboration that I'll explain in a moment, we set that up with some wonderful musical depictions of the visual arts and works that really take the notion of a canvas, paint, and technique and put it into orchestral technique, orchestrational technique, compositional technique. We begin with our composer of the year and the largest work that we feature of his over the season, Adam Schoenberg's Finding Rothko for chamber orchestra. And it's four specific depictions within a chamber orchestra context of four works of Mark Rothko: Orange, Yellow, Red, and Wine. This came to me for two reasons. The first is that I've had this collaboration with Adam in the past, but it also happened to align with my attendance at the Arkansas Repertory Theater of Red, which I thought was one of the best productions they've done in many years, and I enjoyed it tremendously. So I kind of had Rothko on my mind, and specifically some of his works of that title, Red. It was not hard then to make the connection with Adam's work, and I thought, well, we have this notion of a visual arts festival and collaboration. Let's set some of that up by presenting this work. He'll be our composer of the year. And let's give another piece on this program that gives our audiences a little bit of a sense of how we came to have this possibility. And I thought, well, let's find a great example of the French Impressionists in a work, a suite, if you will, really, that shows different musical depictions of color, of narrative, and of actual visual scenes, and that's the Mother Goose. So we're going to do this suite, which is five movements. It's a piece that a lot of your listeners might think of as maybe a family work. You know, I think of it with the story. You know, you think of children, and you think of maybe a work that you heard in your childhood as part of an educational program. Totally appropriate, but at the same time, it's just one of the best works he ever wrote, and it's full of such tremendous, innovative orchestration and technique, and just the sense of wonder and awe and discovery that is why it works so well in that context for children. So I think it sets up the program very well. And you could hear how people like Adam Schoenberg have been influenced by the possibilities of the French Impressionists. But that notion of depicting a scene or a narrative in sound preceded the Impressionists, it preceded the Romantics. And one of the great examples of that, of course, is the Pastoral Symphony of Beethoven, where he depicts things like a storm or the coming of the sun coming out after the storm and the raindrops in the sound of the orchestra. Now, Beethoven didn't have that idea himself, of course, for the first time. There are people like Vivaldi that preceded him and many, many before that as well. But these are some of the best examples of scenes in nature, scenes on the canvas depicted in music. Beethoven and Blue Jeans has to have a big Beethoven work, and we haven't done the Sixth Symphony together. It will be one of the few works that we haven't done together now in the Beethoven repertoire. I'm thrilled that we're going to be tackling this one. It's one of my absolute favorites. Again, it's one of the most innovative and interesting of his symphonies, and it does some things that none of the other symphonies do. And during this piece, we're going to be doing a collaboration with the painter Barry Thomas in something that's never been done before. There have been lots of different orchestras that have had a painter do something on stage during a performance, but we're actually going to film the painter as we are playing, and he won't know what he's going to paint until he hears it. So it'll be a symbiotic relationship. He'll be influenced by us, we'll be influenced by him, and this is how. We're going to then project the image of what he's painting over the top of the orchestra on a scrim or a screen. So the audience won't have to actually look at the painter to see the image. You could look at the painter to see his technique and what he's doing, but really, if you want to just focus your entire attention, ears, eyes, and everything else directly at the orchestra, you'll actually be able to see simultaneously as you hear the orchestra's sound coming from the exact same space. And my hope is that the result will be kind of an organism. It will be, the music will be influenced by the painting will be influenced by the music, and all of this will be able to be witnessed in real time simultaneously by the audience without divided attention. This is an innovative way to finish the season. Well, I see no other way but being able to hear Beethoven's familiar Sixth Symphony in a completely new way.
That was Philip Mann, Arkansas Symphony's music director-conductor. The first Masterworks concerts for the season are September the 30th and October the 1st. For tickets and more information, call the Symphony Office, 501-666-1761, extension 100, or visit arkansasymphony.org. And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.